Hey everyone, first off, we at The Familiar Strange want to acknowledge and celebrate the first Australians on whose lands we are producing this podcast and pay our respect to the elders of the Bunurong peoples past and present. Let's go. Hello and welcome to The Familiar Strange. I am Emma Quilty, your Familiar Stranger for today. Today I am speaking to Matthew Archer. We will be talking about Matthew's brilliant and incisive new book, Unsustainable: Measurement Reporting and the Limits of Corporate Sustainability. Here it is, me and Matthew Archer. Would you mind giving us an overview of sort of the book and the three projects that went into, you know, creating the book?
The research the book is based on started with my PhD research and back in 2015. And this was an ethnography. It ended up being sort of an ethnographic study of these corporate sustainability professionals who were working mostly in Geneva. Yeah, so I was embedded in these different organizations in Geneva for sort of varying periods of time during the year that I was there, but also used that as a way to sort of reach out to people who were passing through Geneva for conferences or who were also sort of affiliated with these organizations or working for these companies in sort of other offices. So that was sort of my in. Ended up, yeah, doing a lot of participant observation, going to lots of conferences. I mean, Geneva, I think, has like two or three conferences probably a day that are related to sustainability somehow. And it's sort of a very elite world, right? Like even just getting into Geneva, being able to afford a hotel already sort of signifies that you have a bit of money behind you at least, or some kind of government or corporate backing. And then lots of interviews with people who were passing through Geneva, who were working permanently in Geneva. The second project then was a postdoc project that I was a co-investigator on this grant in Denmark that looked at sort of the role of sustainability standards and the governance of the Kenyan tea supply chain. And so two of my colleagues on that project were really looking at sort of the farm labor and sort of how this affected things on the farms in Kenya, at sort of trading sites, so at the auction house and at the brokerage firms in Kenya, also in Dubai, where there's this free port where a lot of tea is flowing through and it's packaged, and then some of the trading spots in Europe. And then my part on that project was really looking at the standards themselves and how the standards get produced, sort of the negotiations that go into these sort of constantly revised sustainability standards. So things like fair trade, things like Rainforest Alliance, but also these organizations like the Ethical Tea Partnership. And then the third project was sort of running in parallel to that, which was just a bit of a fluke that I could do it, because I reached out to somebody who... Yeah, I saw writing about sustainable finance on Twitter, and I thought I'll ask him for an interview, sort of continuing some PhD work. But then he seemed very interested in then doing a bigger project in their bank. So he set up a lot of interviews, and I ended up being able to sort of interview their entire sustainability team, meet with them several times, visit the offices. And then they set up a lot of interviews with portfolio managers, which is also quite rare, I think. But they were also quite interested in knowing sort of how portfolio managers, sort of the cogs in the investing machine, think about these sustainability efforts. So it ended up being quite an interesting little side project. That was sort of, it wasn't so many interviews, but it was like stretched over sort of 2.5 years, because I was doing it basically in my free time, sort of on the side of this other project. But it ended up being quite central to the book because I think these investor pressures are sort of one of the big drivers. And I had gotten to that a bit in Geneva, sort of almost 10 years ago now. But that's a very closed off world normally, this sort of elite finance, right? So this was kind of like at the very least, it sort of confirmed a lot of things and also I think shed some new things. Yeah. So those are the three sort of projects that it builds on.
Fantastic. I want to touch back on something you said before about the ethnographic approach that you took to these projects. Since this is an anthropology-focused podcast and a lot of our audience listeners are very interested in anthropology or they're anthropologists themselves, and this idea of industry ethnography is, gaining more and more traction and becoming more popular. And I know colleagues of mine who use this method. Can you dive a little bit more deeply into how that unfolded and what that was like? How did you get access?
I mean, there's a lot of discussion about this, right? Because a lot of people are doing this sort of corporate ethnography now, boardroom ethnography, like really trying to sort of get into the center of the action. And like, I think for a long time we've left that up to sort of organizational sociologists who are much more comfortable sort of disciplinarily, right? Relying just on interviews, if that. And then we sort of, especially in sort of corporate sustainability and CSR research and anthropology, Marina Welker's book was really kind of a like a watershed moment in this literature, I think, where she sort of got into this boardroom and into these sort of very corporate spaces. But then that's still quite it's still quite hard to get access to these places, right? You need to know people. You need to sort of have some inside connections. Karen Ho's work is sort of very similar in this sense. Like she had connections via sort of students and sort of clubs when she was at Princeton. So being sort of plugged in already to these elite sort of networks or these network making sites, I think is quite important. And so there is sort of on one hand like a bit of luck involved in this, but then my colleague at CBS, Dan Sulelez, also writes about sort of does anthropology of finance and has written quite extensively on this and also on the methodological side of this. And he sort of says, it is about luck in a way, but it's also really about persistence and about flexibility and sort of what we sort of think of as ethnographic research, not sort of pushing back or that we need to sort of push back against this sort of obsession with the like a year in the field as if that's right as if that's something that just like magically then gives you some kind of knowledge about what you're studying or 2 years in the field now, which is becoming quite normal for PhD students, I think. So I think I also sort of shifted my own approach, right? Like in my PhD, I really was trying to be in one place for a year to do this sort of proper ethnography of these things. And then I shifted a bit where I was focusing more on interviews, on sort of semi-extended sort of week-long site visits to places, sort of being embedded in a place for a few days. And I think that's still quite valid. In terms of access, I think obviously being sort of a white man who had been, I especially in my PhD research, I was studying at Yale in the forestry school, and now it's called environmental studies, but it used to be called the forestry school. And so there was already a network. So the forestry school has a master's program in environmental management, and a lot of people graduate out of that program and then they go into corporate sustainability. A lot of them are working for these quite elite NGOs. So I already like I could just log into LinkedIn. I could find people. There were always people at any organization I wanted to study. There was always somebody who had graduated from the forestry school. So it was quite easy to get in touch with them. As a student, I wasn't so threatening, right? As if I had been sort of an anthropology professor or something. And then because I was doing my PhD in the forestry school rather than in an anthropology department, or geography department, I think that. That I sort of looked like one of them in a way. So I think they were quite comfortable. They saw me sort of, they saw themselves in me a bit, like this young sustainability student, trying to understand corporate sustainability, make a little impact. So I think it was quite a, I think these sort of factors all sort of helped me access these sites.
Brilliant. That's I could really I really enjoyed your reflexiveness and discussing that positionality really early on the book. It really framed it really well. But I also really enjoyed your candor through the book when you would sort of have missteps where you describe, I think it was in your PhD set of your research where you were asking the sustainability professionals to define sustainability, and one of them pointed out to you as an anthropology undergraduate, that's like asking an anthropologist to define culture, right? Like, and you sort of realize that, like, you know, you've got all of these connections and you're part of this world, but not part of this world. And it's sort of just, you were just positioned perfectly to do exactly this type of research. And yeah, it absolutely shone through. There was a metaphor that kind of came up like throughout the whole book, that sustainability professionals reach for, that sustainability is a journey rather than a destination. And that's as interesting as it is cringy. Can you unpack that for me a little bit more?
I mean, on one hand, it's kind of obviously true, right? Like you can't be like fully sustainable as a company. I think it's sort of a it's a bit of like a an admission that they know it's sort of what they're trying to achieve is impossible. But on the other hand, it sort of gives them something to like constantly work for, something to constantly do. Like it protects their jobs, right? If they say like I'm always going to be needed, it keeps this sort of sustainability industry alive because there's always some way to improve stuff. But then it also really creates sort of an excuse for greenwashing that is hard to then accuse them of greenwashing, right? Because they're saying like we're improving, we're learning something. So this is one thing I say about like all these this sort of obsession with metrics, right? Is that like they're always talking about like some, you know, we need to come up with a better method of measuring things, we need to come up with a better method of reporting things. But at the same time, one of the main requirements for all this data is that it's consistent, that it's comparable over time. So if every 2 or 3 years you're changing the way that an indicator is defined, and the way that you're going out and measuring these indicators, right, then you're sort of, you never have that baseline because every few years you're changing the way that you've measured something or what you're suddenly interested in. So this is constantly shifting. They're sort of constantly, yeah, shifting the goalposts a bit, but also sort of shifting where ground zero is. So I think that this sort of rhetoric of the journey rather than a destination is quite useful in that sense, that they can always say, you know, we're working on it, we're learning these things, and then you never really have to actually show, like, it's not, it doesn't have to be so results oriented, right? Because you can talk about how you're improving or how you're planning to improve or how you're committed to planning to improve, right? So it just, these strings of verbs keep getting longer and longer that they use to talk about their work, but it's still positioning themselves very explicitly on that path.
Yeah. And especially when they're the ones setting their own benchmarks to keep improving against. That's another really interesting layer to all of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think they would say that they're not setting the benchmarks, right? That this is all like external, it's all sort of independent organizations, but then what they don't tell you is that these independent organizations are like multi-stakeholder initiatives, right? And there's now sort of quite a bit of critical research and sort of you know, organization studies and political economy about how these multi-stakeholder initiatives like pretty much invariably sort of prioritize the interests of the best organized stakeholders, right? And that's like the best organized stakeholder is not going to be a bunch of farmers, like poor farmers spread across the global south, right? It's going to be Nestle, it's going to be Unilever, it's going to be these huge companies that yeah, have the resources. They have a team of sustainability professionals that are working on this. They have lawyers, they have management consultants, they have all these people that are making sure that their narrative is sort of very tight and coherent. So they are sort of, I mean, they're not directly setting these things, but then of course they are very influential in these sort of spaces where the rules are set. And these rules are then voluntary, right? So it's not even like it's not even like they're behind the scenes sort of making some law or infecting regulation, which they're also doing, of course. But these are the things that sort of are the public face, the thing that you see in supermarkets, right? The little standards, the logos on things. That's what they're also like very interested in sort of determining.
Well, you've just touched on something there, the recognizable logo, that vignette you have at the start of chapter three, I think it is, around the green tree, the green frog. When you were describing certification and the global tea industry, as you mentioned Unilever before, so I'd love to know more about your time during that set of ethnography.
Yeah, it was an interesting time because you sort of know, like, if you read stuff about these standards, you sort of know how they work. You know, sort of the mechanisms behind them. You know that it's sort of their claims to social impact, especially, but even some environmental impacts are quite tenuous. And I think the nice thing about this research, or one of the sort of pleasant surprises of this, is that, like, the people that I study are also very aware of these critiques. They're very aware of sort of the shortcomings of these approaches. And they're all like, I mean, I never interviewed anybody. I never sort of observed or engaged with anybody that, like, I didn't feel like was, like, quite a good person, right? That they're very interested in making a difference. They really, like, are quite committed to this. A lot of them sort of point out very explicitly that, like, you know, I could be making a lot more money doing something else, but, like, I'm really passionate about this. That's quite a privileged thing to say, of course, but it's also true. In a way, a lot of them could be making a lot more money in other fields. That's changing a bit now that sustainability is becoming quite profitable. But I think it still holds. But then they also, like, they're trained, they're sort of socialized in a way that makes them see problems in a certain way. And that means that they can only sort of accept certain kinds of solutions as valid. So you can imagine somebody that studied economics in undergrad, and then they went and they studied environmental economics as a graduate student. Like, they're like, when I mean, I did a master's in environmental economics, and sort of the sort of what was considered sort of critical in that program a lot of times was things about, like, problems with the methods for sort of estimating somebody's willingness to pay for something, right? And never this never there weren't really these conversations about, like, does it matter what somebody's willing to pay? Like, even if we could sort of perfectly capture this, like, why are we using sort of somebody's willingness to consume something, or an individual's willingness to pay for something, as any kind of, like, policy advice, right? Or any kind of, like, strategic grounds. So I think a lot of people really come into this field really wanting to make a difference, but they see things like, they see every environmental problem and every social problem as sort of a market failure or some kind of inefficiency. And then, how do you fix a failing market? How do you fix a market failure, an inefficient market? It's by, like, improving it, by making sure that the market is able to do sort of what it's supposed to do. That means making sure that it has sort of perfect, or as near perfect, information as possible, so that it can sort of price things the right way. But obviously, in practice, that never really happens, right? So I think it's but it's quite hard to see that if you've been told for a long time, and sort of everything that you read sort of academically, but also everything you read that's being published by these organizations and stuff, is really talking about, you know, increasingly about data and market-driven things. And you know, I talk about some of these people in the book that were really like, you know, I want to make a difference, but I don't think, like, being an activist or blocking a road is the right way. I think we need to work with the market to achieve these things. And it's like kind of baffling in the moment. You have to sort of make yourself keep a straight face, because you're like, well, it doesn't work. Like, I don't know. So yeah, but it's also just the way these people are taught. So.
Yeah, 100%. That trope of, trying to work from within the belly of the beast and improve it, was very clear. In your conversations with people, because you obviously spent a lot of time with these people. I know you did some, research assistant work, like working within these organizations, not just going to the industry conferences. Did you get through to anyone? Did you, did everyone have any sort of like significant reflexive, I get it kind of moment? Or were they just so encultured and socialized into these ways of thinking?
It's hard to say. I think people like, I think a lot of people sort of would more or less totally agree with what I say about their work. Like a lot of people I've talked to since then and sort of stayed in touch with, friends who are working in this industry, like they gave a lot of feedback on the book and sort of drafts and sort of ideas that were floating around. And I think, yeah, for the most part, they agreed. It's just that they don't see sort of, they don't sort of see the possibility for any kind of alternative, right? They don't see, they see it as like so hard and sort of, yeah, to do anything else, that this kind of systems change would be like such a deviation from sort of the lifestyle that they're used to and what most people are used to, that they're sort of very against it, right? And so I think it's not so much like they're very reflexive people. They're very, you know, they're normally quite smart people. They're interested in stuff. Like they're, you know, there's nothing wrong with them as people. But yeah, they're just working within this system that sort of constrains what you're able to do, what you're able to sort of imagine, right? So I think yeah, it was they didn't have like they agreed, right? They just don't know what to do about it. Sort of in the same way that I mean I'm a similar way, right? Like obviously I agree with what I wrote, but I'm also quite confused about what, like some people ask like, well, what should we do? And I'm like, well, I also don't really know, right? Yeah. Which is always a, yeah, it's especially like if a practitioner picks up the book and is like, okay, well, now I want to change my life. That's going to be a disappointment, I think. So.
No, it's definitely not a a how-to book.
No.
You just mentioned something that reminded me of yeah, so you were saying about how these people are, deeply reflexive and they're, essentially good people. There was a vignette where you were explaining, you were giving like a high-level introduction to Bourdieu's theory of social capital to sustainability professionals in Geneva, and that conversation was so fascinating. And that sort of back and forth you were having with them, and then the conversation about information and data. I was hoping you could recount a little bit of that story for us, for me.
Yeah, so we were doing this like at the time there were all these sort of efforts going on to come up with ways to measure sort of social impacts and social capital and all these things. And I was involved in one of these, and we were going through sort of yeah, how we might go about that. And I was sort of the resident academic, the sort of young PhD student who was in there. And so we were talking, they had asked me to sort of come up with more of like an academic background and literature review on sort of efforts to measure social capital. So, you know, sociologists have spent quite a lot of time on sort of social capital and cultural capital and these various things. So I was just sort of going through this, yeah, quite a high level overview of sort of these theories of social capital. And like every point that they could sort of latch onto that was something that would then be sort of directly relevant to what they were doing, or that would be sort of easy to quantify, or especially that was sort of supporting what they were trying, like that seemed to support what they were trying to do, was they really like latched onto these things. So I thought that was quite interesting. And I've sort of seen this in more recent research that the book doesn't cover. About sort of renewable energy transitions and sort of pointing out the problem that like you know renewable energy actually requires a lot more mining and they you know what about degrowth and they latch onto these like little parts of degrowth which should be you know like kind of a refutation of this sort of green growth theory that we can just sort of or this sort of ecological modernization, this idea that we can sort of outsmart nature and sort of figure out a way to just dig up a lot of lithium and fix the problem. So they pick up on sort of the parts of degrowth about like, oh, you know, reducing energy consumption is good, like some lifestyle changes to be more sustainable is good, but then they're very good at sort of separating these parts from the other parts of something. So this was, yeah, sort of how that conversation went as well, I think.
I just want to circle back to something you were saying earlier around fixing the market and fixing the market with more data and information, and the Bourdieu information vignette kind of sparked that. Did you observe any conversations or concerns come up around surveillance or like data privacy, data sovereignty, any of those sorts of things?
Yeah, I don't talk about it in the book so much, but I have a paper about this, on sort of how this new focus and this sort of new obsession with data and sustainability certifications is creating these spaces that I call surveillable spaces. And it's this idea that sort of like if you're not sort of acquiescing to this monitoring regime, that's required to sort of generate all this data about social and environmental impacts, then you can very easily be sort of framed or cast as unsustainable or sort of anti-sustainable. And we're seeing this now where sort of these futuristic imaginaries of sort of what sustainability might look like in the future. And it's about drones sort of constantly hovering above these farms to make sure that the right amount of workers are working in the farm. That would then be sort of attached to payroll data and employment data, but also to make sure that there aren't kids in the field or something. And so this kind of set like. It's very rarely, if ever, brought up like, oh, what about the privacy of the farm worker? Like to have this drone sort of hovering above the farm all the time, or these even like a drone spot check, but even like stuff that, like wages, right? Like we would be quite uneasy, I think, if somebody said, okay, I'm starting a new certification scheme for universities, a fair labor certification scheme. And in order for the university to get that, they have to give us data on all of their employees, who they've hired, when they've hired them, their gender, their age, and their salary, their monthly salary, how many hours they work, right? How often they're in their office, all these things, right? How much internet they're using, sort of what websites they're like you could get to all of these things, right? That seem crazy to us, but these things that are like real incursions into people's sort of private economic lives, that just are taken sort of totally for granted in sustainability, especially now that sustainability is so sort of data hungry. I think, and then, I talk a bit in the book about how I mentioned this in the book, but how sort of surveillance has become very normalized in sustainability, but more through the lens of this sort of this datafied sustainability, and sort of ignoring that data comes from or is about people.
Yeah, absolutely. The strand of techno-solutionism and sustainability in the book was so brilliant. And what you just described here, the futuristic imaginary of drones over farms, might be a techno-utopia, utopian image, but it is absolutely horrifying and dystopian to me. The Amazonification of labor, right? And that example you gave of universities, like they're never going to test these technologies on, universities or banks or any of these sort of elite institutions. It's always like, oh, if we're going to test blockchain, let's go to the Pacific Islands and see if it works there, right? Like, oh, and also, the idea, this is something I've come up against in the Net Zero Precincts project that I've been working in, the idea of, more data. We need more data on, the energy consumption of the buildings and how many students are going to be there and how many students are in, each room. Completely, obfuscating the issue that data takes energy to store, right? And that's just completely absent from these conversations. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
That was, I mean, that was totally absent in these conversations as well. It was, I mean, there was quite a funny moment, sort of, so, I used to work at CBS at Copenhagen Business School. And there you get into your office with a key card, and it creates a log of sort of when you go in, every time you've unlocked the door. And so they have access to this already, of course, for like building security and stuff, because you, like everybody's key opens everybody's door. And then they wanted to start tracking that because, yeah, everybody knew that sort of they were going to start suggesting that people share offices because they were running out of office space. But their excuse was sustainability, right? They were trying to get around sort of GDPR violations, all this stuff, and they were really saying like, oh, this is about sort of energy efficiency. We want to make sure that people are people. If you work only on like if we can see a pattern that you only work on Mondays and Tuesdays, and somebody else only works on Thursdays and Fridays, we might put you together in a bigger office rather than just having your office heated and cooled, or just heated in Denmark, but heated when it's empty. People obviously push back against this, one, because they don't want to be pushed to share an office with anybody, but two, because of privacy concerns. And this is really like the most basic level, right? Of sort of surveillance. They're already doing it. I think people were very shocked to know that they were doing that. But this would be sort of the bare minimum, right? That a worker on a farm would be subject to. Where sort of all of their movement at work is tracked, everything they're doing at work is tracked, and very explicitly tracked, right?
Yeah, and see, it's no surprise to me that the staff would push back on this. What concerns me, especially working in the project that I'm working in, is that so much of this data is already being gathered on students. 99% of it, they're not aware of, what is actually being gathered on them and what reports are being, created and sent to whom. There was a recent piece in the news. I'm not sure if you saw this around vending machines at a university started glitching, and
Yeah,
they
with
realized
the face thing.
the facial
Wow.
recognition. Like
Wow.
this, it's
Yeah, it's crazy.
absolutely, yeah, it's absolutely bizarre. But this is the future that we're trundling towards, because technology is, the shiny, object that's going to, solve all of these things, sort of magically, hopefully, it's really, yeah, it's
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very like it's quite on one hand it's really different. What's sort of explicitly driving these things, right? Like the vending machines, it was really about like eye tracking, and like I think they wanted to be able to see, what somebody's looking at, like what their sort of eyes glance over, and then what they finally choose. That was like obviously very driven by like sort of marketing and marketization, I guess. Yeah, the idea was that if you have all this like crazy amounts of data about every single individual's, not just the choice that they make, but the process that they use to make that choice, sort of in what they're browsing and then what they finally land on, right? That then you'll be able to be more efficient. And I think that's like in the very different context of sustainability, it's exactly that same kind of logic that the more data you have about everything, the more efficient you'll be able to make your supply chain, or you'll be able to make your production process, or whatever. And efficiency is sort of like always associated with sustainability and of being better and being less wasteful, right? Even though it's very much sort of actually just an economic sort of mathematical concept. So I think that's one thing I try to get at in the book, right? Is that there is this sort of market logic that this obsession with data is bringing into everything, because that's what's sort of driving it. It's what underlies it, but it's also how it's supposed to be used to make a difference.
Is there anything from the book that you wanted to cover today that I haven't touched on yet?
I don't know. I think we sort of covered a lot of it. I think I mean, one question I've been getting a lot is like, if this is sort of how my informants define sustainability around these sort of very like quantitative approaches, a lot of times, and what's sort of the alternative, like what would be a better definition or a better approach to sustainability, which I've sort of been finding quite hard to answer. But I do think that, right, the answer sort of lies in looking to like the way other people with like very different kinds of motivations and stuff, right, have than what a corporation cares about or what an investor cares about, have approached this. And I think in the book, what I found quite helpful was this definition from the Sustainable Development Institute from the College of the Menominee Nation. So sustainability now is very much defined around these three pillars. So it's the economic, it's the environmental, and it's the social, which people call people, planet, profit, right? And then you have you have all these things that sort of go into making these different dimensions of sustainability commensurable, right? So you have that's where the obsession with sort of measuring environmental impacts as some kind of indicator of how much pollution is out there, how much water you're using, how much energy you're using. And I think that if you and then with social impact, sort of focusing on that, that's why when people talk about social impact or social capital, it sort of changes from these very big and very important conversations around things like gender-based violence or, child slavery, to things like, the percentage of women on in senior management positions and the number of hours that a company's employees have spent volunteering for sort of various social or community causes or something. And like all of these, I mean, it's obviously sort of very multidimensional problems, and they get boiled down to these very measurable sort of sub dimensions of those problems, right? And then that sort of becomes what we start to think about in terms of sustainability. So we sort of start to congratulate companies that add a few percentage points to their sort of women leadership teams and that decide to pay a little more in to employees who want to go volunteer. But when you think about a company like, Unilever or Olam or ADM or some of these like huge agricultural companies, right? Their biggest social impacts are not how many women are working in their headquarters. It's about how they treat women farmers, sort of the millions of women farmers who are producing stuff for them. So I think that sort of the first step is really looking for sort of definitions of sustainability or definitions of sustainable development that sort of not only sort of resist this, and in the book I call it like a commensurative impulse to sort of compare these things in very quantitative terms and in a way that like ideally for a lot of my informants would be explicitly monetized. And so not just sort of refusing that, but coming up with a definition that doesn't even allow it in the first place, right? That like where it's not even sort of on the radar that you would measure these things. So I think that's where you have this definition from the Sustainable Development Institute. It focuses on things like land and sovereignty. It focuses on things like institutions, on technological development, on sort of people's perceptions of the problem. And this is things that like you can't like you don't measure sovereignty, right? Like either people are sovereign, either people have control over their land, or they don't, or somebody else does, right? So this isn't something that then a company can say, well, we've increased the sovereignty of these people by 14% last year. Like these are things where you have to go out and talk to people. You have sort of no-go zones, right? Where you say, okay, this is not sustainable if it's doing this, period. Not putting it on some kind of scale. So I think that that's quite a good first step. And then I think really situating these struggles sort of in both the global and sort of the local is very important. Whereas now we have this very sort of like one size fits all approach that's very sort of market driven, that's about collecting all this data. And the idea is that you can replicate that anywhere. And of course that we sort of know that that doesn't work. So I think that would be one thing that I think sort of the book ends. Hopefully that's like one of the takeaways is that we need this more sort of localized, sort of non-measured approach to sustainability.
It's a fantastic challenge and I think invitation for the book and for this episode to close on. Before we let you go, can you tell us where we can get your brand new book?
So it's published by NYU Press. I think if you're in the US or Canada, you can buy it on their website with a discount code for 30%, and that's NYU AU 30. Otherwise, in the UK and Europe, you can buy it through the Combined Academic Publishers website, maybe in Australia as well. But then it's also on sort of most book retailer websites. So just sort of whatever the local. I don't want to promote Amazon, so I'm not going to say Amazon. But I think you can find it on most websites now, just because they distribute through this University Press Association. So
Fantastic. And
sadly, the
we.
discount code.
Oh, no, sorry,
Sorry,
you go.
I think sadly the discount code only applies for the U.S. and Canada. So
Oh,
for some
that's
reason, so.
okay. We have listeners all around the world, so we will include all of those links and we can include that code for our US listeners. Yeah.
Okay.
Fantastic. Wonderful. Thank you so much for giving me your time and for sending
No, thank
through
you.
the book for me to enjoy. I just had such a brilliant time reading it this week. It's
Well,
so
thank
fantastic. I
you.
can't wait to share it with our Net Zero Precincts team and see what they think, see if I can ruffle some feathers.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for, yeah, the invitation. This was really fun.
Was it, me and Matthew Archer. Today's episode was produced by all of us at The Familiar Strange with support from the Australian Anthropological Society and the Australian National University's College of Asia and the Pacific and the College of Arts and Social Sciences, produced in collaboration with the American Anthropological Association. Subscribe to the Familiar Strange podcast. You can find us on all familiar places, including Spotify. And if you'd like to support us, please check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/thefamiliarstrange. Not The Strange Familiars, which is another fun podcast, just not ours. You can find the show notes, including a list of all the books and papers mentioned today, plus our blog about anthropology's role in the world at thefamiliarstrange.com. If you want to contribute to the blog or have anything to say to me or the other hosts of this program, email us at submissions@thefamiliarstrange.com and be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Music by Pete Dabrow. Special thanks to Nick Farrelly, Will Grant, Matrian Pierce, and Maud Rowe. Our podcast executive producer is the wonderful Matthew Fung. Thanks for listening. Until next time, keep talking strange.